From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, is ISIS getting stronger?
I think their ideology is getting stronger. I'm never worried about their numbers and their Toyota truck.
Obama says the U.S. and Qatar are united in the fight against Islamic State. West Coast U.S. ports are busy but struggling with a backlog. And finding an organism that eats rocks? It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter held talks Monday in Kuwait with top U.S. commanders and diplomats on U.S. efforts to fight the Islamic State group. Officials said the meeting was to allow Carter to better understand the range of efforts being pursued to defeat the militant group. Fahim Yunus is an executive committee member of the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community of the U.S. and a senior fellow of the Center for Ethics at the University of Baltimore. We asked him what actions the U.S. should take to defeat ISIS.
I believe we are on the right track, and I admire the efforts that the president and his administration are making. It should be a multifaceted approach of working with the Arab countries, having them not only defeat this ideology by theological principles, but also by putting their army and boots on the ground and cutting the supply chain of ISIS. And then in the long run, like the president said, improve the economic conditions in these countries. And just the fact that hopefully the wars will end and they will see some prosperity, and therefore they will have a stronger identity about themselves and life will become worth living. So I believe it's a multifaceted approach as the president is pursuing.
Well, you're saying boots on the ground. Should that be an Arab coalition with the boots on the ground, or should the United States join those ground forces? The president's been a little hesitant about doing that.
As Ahmadiyya Muslim community, we strongly believe that these should be Arab countries. And not only because politically that's the right thing, but Susan, Islamically also that is the right thing to do, because ISIS looks at, you know, for them, there's a very small sliver of people who should be allowed to live, and they are trying to destroy the churches and mosques and synagogues. And there's a verse in Holy Quran that clearly says that such people should be stopped with force, because to protect religious freedom. So I believe not just politically, but Islamically and religiously as well, it is the duty of the Arab state.
Many people around the world see the members of ISIS as monsters. Why do they have so much power to recruit? Why does anybody join them?
That's a great question. And first of all, I, again, completely agree that they don't represent Islam. Nothing that they're doing is Islamic. But there is a lack of identity in that part of the world. The people have high rates of illiteracy. There is poverty. These wars have created a situation where the young minds are vulnerable. And therefore, these people who have deep resentments, and these are political resentments, their clergy is actually abusing certain verses in the Quran. I think we cannot just completely remove the fact that they have some connection with Islam. They have a very perverted, very complicated, skewed view of Islam. And it is the resentment that these wars over the past 10, 15 years have generated, which then make it very easy. You know, when we just callously call something collateral damage, and these are hundreds of thousands of orphans in the age of 10, 12, 15, we've pretty much given them a purpose to hate us. And that purpose is being exploited by the likes of ISIS.
Do you think ISIS is getting stronger at this time?
I think their ideology is getting stronger. I'm never worried about their numbers and their Toyota trucks. But I believe that it is their ideology that more and more people will join them if this anti-Islamic rhetoric that is now drumming up in America and Europe continues. Every time somebody tries to link it with Islam and calls them Islamic State and Islamic radicals, President is absolutely right. This is what is going to generate more and more resentment among the Muslim youth, and this is what is going to allow ISIS to recruit more people and become stronger militarily.
Fahim Yunus, executive committee member of the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community of the U.S. and a senior fellow of the Center for Ethics at the University of Baltimore. U.S. President Barack Obama welcomed Qatar's emir to the White House Tuesday, calling the Arab country a strong partner in the battle to degrade and defeat the Islamic State militant group, which has taken large amounts of territory in Iraq and Syria. VOA correspondent Arup Pandey has more from the White House.
The visit by Qatari Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, his first to the White House since he assumed power in 2013, comes just days after Qatar protested Egyptian airstrikes against Islamic State targets in Libya. Cairo launched the strikes last week after a video emerged showing the militant group murdering 21 Egyptian Christians. Qatar recalled its ambassador to Egypt to protest what it called unilateral action that could hurt innocent civilians, revealing a fracture in the coalition long touted by the Obama administration. But on Tuesday, the American president sat alongside Qatar's emir in the Oval Office and expressed appreciation for the work Qatar has done in coordinating with other members of the coalition in the fight. Mr. Obama said the U.S. and Qatar are committed to defeating Islamic State, supporting the Iraqi people, and stabilizing Syria. The two leaders also discussed the unrest in Yemen and Libya and the importance of bringing peace to the region.
I think we had a significant meeting of the minds in our shared belief that the more that we can work with all the countries in the region to try to find political solutions to problems, the more that we can reduce sectarian tensions in the regions and isolate violent extremists, the more effective we can be.
The Qatari emir was brief in his remarks, echoing the American president on the strong ties between his country and the U.S. Sheikh Tamim also expressed concern about the turmoil in the Middle East and North Africa.
We're concerned as well about the terrorist groups in our region. I think we all share the same view, the reason why those terrorist groups are growing in our region.
The remarks come from the leader of a country that U.S. Treasury officials say for years openly financed Hamas and allegedly supported extremist groups in Syria. Qatari officials have denied such allegations. And when asked about Qatar's alleged financing of extremist groups following Tuesday's talks, White House spokesman Josh Earnest told reporters that the U.S. does not necessarily agree with the Qatari government on every issue, but
the bottom line is that our interests with Qatar converge somewhat more often than they actually diverge. That Qatar has been of significant help on a range of regional issues, including Afghanistan, Iran. As you know, even the Qataris have even agreed to host a regional training site for the moderate Syrian opposition.
Earnest noted that the Qatari government also has been willing to work closely with the Obama administration on the issue of terrorism financing in preventing Islamic State from carrying out attacks. During the White House meeting, President Obama said he gave the emir an update on the Iran nuclear talks and the goal of ensuring that Iran does not have a nuclear weapon. The two leaders also discussed the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, with Sheikh Tamim noting Mr. Obama's commitment to finding a solution on the issue. Aru Pandey, VOA News at the White House.
The World Health Organization is launching a $1 billion appeal to provide life-saving health services for 21 million people in the Central African Republic, Iraq, South Sudan, and Syria. The UN agency warns health conditions in all four countries are deteriorating because of raging conflicts that show no signs of abating. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization has launched its appeal on behalf of the entire health cluster of more than 30 international humanitarian organizations. The World Health Organization is running a 65% shortfall from last year's multi-million dollar appeal for the Central African Republic, Iraq, South Sudan, and Syria. It warns continued lack of support will have dire consequences for tens of millions of people. Most of the money, $687 million, will go for Syria, where 12.2 million people need humanitarian health support. WHO country representative for Syria, Elizabeth Hoff, says one of the biggest challenges is reaching people with aid. She notes 2.7 million people are residing in Islamic State-controlled areas, and another 4.8 million are living in other hard-to-reach areas.
People have more difficulties to cope, particularly with the winter season, with a high number of respiratory diseases. But what is the main fear that WHO has as we are moving forward is really the risk of waterborne diseases. We have in 2014 31,460 cases of hepatitis A reported, And this normally we see in when the weather is warmer and so on, but it just tells you that people no longer have the same access to safe drinking water as before.
Nearly $219 million is needed to provide humanitarian health support for 4 million people in Iraq, more than half internally displaced by the IS onslaught. The country has been plagued by health crises since the first Gulf War 2 decades ago. The WHO says the country is suffering a serious shortage of life-saving medicines. It says child immunization rates are very low, and it is concerned about a resurgence of polio and an increase in measles. It says a major focus of its support will be on building up primary health care services as they can be made readily available for people in need. The agency is asking for $90 million to provide health care for 3.35 million people in South Sudan. WHO country representative Tarande Constant Manzila says getting to inaccessible areas will be very expensive.
Last year, for example, in 2014, we counted more than 300 UN health flights from out of Juba to deliver services and goods in the many states in more than 80 locations. The money is needed today for the purchase and the prepositioning of all the medical supply and also mounting operation to continue delivering health services during the rainy season, which is going to start at the end of May.
The WHO reports nearly 1.5 million people are in need of health support in the Central African Republic, and $48 million is required to provide services, including vaccinating children against measles and other killer disease, tackling malaria, respiratory infections, and life-threatening conditions such as obstetric emergencies. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Most West Coast U.S. ports have been busy since Friday when negotiators reached a tentative settlement in a 9-month labor dispute and work slowdown. As Mike O'Sullivan reports, both sides say with the cargo moving again, they can focus on long-term problems.
Dozens of ships have been docked or waiting offshore at 29 West Coast ports, and port officials say it will take months to process all the cargo. Most dock workers have returned to work but must still vote on the tentative 5-year contract. U.S. Labor Secretary Thomas Perez had increased pressure as both sides talked in San Francisco, but negotiations were not easy, says Craig Merrilies of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union.
You know, there were a lot of tough issues in this process that lasted over 9 months, and some of them are the kinds of issues that are affecting all workers. That includes the outsourcing of good jobs.
Workers say clerical jobs at the port have been moving to other states and other countries. They are also worried about increasing automation of the port facilities, reducing the need for workers. Those who move goods into and out of the country include this San Francisco coffee company, where a worker scoops coffee beans ready for roasting. Eileen Rinaldi founded the company called Ritual Coffee Roasters.
We are reliant on constant arrivals of coffee in order to have a fresh supply.
Others who rely on the ports, small breweries that use imported hops to brew beer, farmers who need to ship their perishable citrus, and a California children's company that has seen its products, which are manufactured in China, sitting in cargo ships in Oakland Harbor. The cargo is moving again, but long-term problems at the ports must be addressed, says transportation analyst Tom O'Brien of California State University, Long Beach.
The fact that we have larger ships coming in now, that's creating peak demand for labor and for equipment is putting a lot of pressure on our infrastructure. Not only the ports, but the road network, rail capacity, distribution center, and warehousing.
O'Brien says it all needs to be ramped up to meet increasing trade needs in the future. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Scientists thought they knew a lot about how life works until a discovery more than two decades ago challenged conventional beliefs. Scientists found that there are organisms that breathe rocks. It is only recently that the scientific community is accepting that there are organisms that could get energy out of rocks. New discoveries are still being made, including organisms that also eat rocks. Here's Elizabeth Lee with the details.
Kenneth Nielsen can be described in many ways, including expert in microbiology and biochemistry. But that's not the one he is most proud of.
People call me the father of Shewanella.
Shewanella is an unusual bacterium that shocked the scientific community. Nielsen discovered it 25 years ago in a lake. Like other organisms, it breathes oxygen, but it also breathes rock. Nielsen looks at a time-lapse video of the Shewanella breathing rock. It shows a piece of manganese oxide slowly disappearing over several hours.
That particle that you saw disappear before your eyes in 18 hours, under those conditions, should have been stable for thousands of years.
All living things, including people, make energy through what's called electron transfer. It involves taking electrons from the food we eat.
When we breathe in oxygen, we give electrons to it, and it's that voltage that allows us to make energy.
This process usually happens internally. But for the Shewanella and other mineral-breathing organisms, the electron transfer happens outside the cell. When the process was first discovered, it seemed impossible to the scientific community.
This was one of the most exciting times in my career, when you realize that you have something that probably no one else has and that almost no one's going to believe.
Since then, microbiologists have found other organisms that breathe metal. And Nielsen says they are finally making it into science textbooks. Building on Nielsen's work, one researcher in his lab, Annette Rowe, just made another discovery. Bacteria that eat rock in ocean sediments as an energy source and transfer electrons from outside the cell membrane into the cell.
So you don't actually have to internalize it to get energy from it.
It's going to be as wacky as 25 years ago. Because you could see from the reviews of this that some people just didn't believe it, okay, and they didn't want to believe it.
These findings have implications that extend to outer space and how life might exist on a planet like Mars. Nielsen says one of his former students is now building this instrument that will attach to the arm of a rover and give scientists a special set of eyes on the 2020 Mars mission.
If you picked up a nice fluorescent signal from a Mars rock or a sediment or a core, if we could drill into it, and all of a sudden you saw certain colors of fluorescence, you would say, "Whoop, stop the train. Let's get a sample of this and look at it in more detail."
Meanwhile, scientists are drilling into the lower parts of the Earth's crust, several kilometers down, to see if there are forms of life there, living in ways much different than what we know as life on the surface. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
Researchers are challenging old advice that suggests parents keep peanuts away from young children who are at high risk of developing a peanut allergy. A study published Monday in the New England Journal of Medicine says regularly exposing those kids to peanuts at an early age may actually prevent them from ever developing an allergy. Researchers in Britain looked at a group of 640 children between 4 and 11 months old who had egg allergies or the skin condition eczema that can often be indicators of a peanut allergy risk. Researchers in Britain looked at a group of 640 children. Half of the kids were routinely given peanuts while the others strictly avoided them. By age 5, fewer than 1% of the kids who had peanuts had become allergic, while 17% of the kids who did not eat peanuts had developed an allergy. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yaki in Washington.
This is Today in History. On February 25th, 1570, Pope Pius V excommunicated Queen Elizabeth I of England. The Queen had sided with the Reformed movement against the Roman Catholic Church and had become head of the rival Church of England. Famed French painter Pierre-Auguste Renoir was born on this day in 1841. Along with Claude Monet, Renoir was a leader in the development of the Impressionist style. In 1870, Hiram Rhodes Revels, a Republican from Natchez, Mississippi, was sworn into the U.S. Senate, becoming the first black American to sit in Congress. In 1901, American financier J.P. Morgan incorporated the United States Steel Corporation. U.S. Steel was at one time the largest steel company in the world. In 1932, Austrian immigrant Adolf Hitler became a citizen of Germany. On this day in 1948, Czechoslovak President Eduard Beneš was forced to accept a Soviet-backed communist government following a bloodless coup that ended a brief effort to restore the country's pre-war democracy. In 1956, Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev, in a sensational speech to the 20th Congress of the Communist Party, denounced the personality cult of the late dictator Joseph Stalin. In 1986, Corazon Aquino was sworn in as the new Philippines president. In 2009, in Dhaka, Bangladesh, paramilitary soldiers staged a rebellion, leaving 74 people dead. In November 2013, more than 300 of the mutineers were sentenced to death or life in prison for their part in the revolt. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A core principle of United States foreign policy is the promotion of freedom of expression. After consultations with multiple stakeholders, the Departments of Treasury and Commerce have lifted the restriction on the export of some personal telecommunications devices to Sudan, such as smartphones and computers, to help give the Sudanese greater access to communication tools and better communicate amongst themselves and the world. These changes also support our aim to help Sudanese citizens integrate in the global digital community. The recent decision of the Sudanese government to stifle the press by seizing the full print run of 15 different newspapers made it clear that the Sudanese people need more freedom to access information. This seizure further highlights the importance of this licensing change because it facilitates the ability of the Sudanese to communicate with each other and with the outside world, which is an increasingly necessary step to alleviating poverty. Before this change, U.S. companies that wanted to export these goods, software, or services to Sudan had to seek a specific license from an office in the Treasury Department and authorization from the Department of Commerce. Now, this is no longer required for hardware, software, or related services. Banks, companies, and private citizens will now know that the export and re-export of these items is now permissible under U.S. law. The United States remains a committed partner to the people of Sudan, and as was the case with previous general licenses which authorized the exportation of agricultural commodities and equipment, food, medicine, and medical supplies, and certain academic and professional exchanges, this week's announcement reaffirms that commitment. We have a long history of direct people-to-people exchanges between our citizens, and as the 2013 Academic and Professional General License facilitated cultural, academic, and professional exchanges, which allowed more of us to meet face-to-face, this new general license will promote greater communication among our people and the global community. These changes will give Sudanese students, entrepreneurs, business people, journalists, civic leaders, and others better access to the telecommunications tools they need to study, create, and grow, and serve their communities.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.